So, Rebecca, a patron wrote in about a clinical situation that I wanted to get your opinion on. Is it okay if we read her email and then you can provide some commentary?
Go for it.
All right. Well, let's introduce the podcast first. This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Bloom, and I am a mental health counselor with a full practice in South Seattle.
Meaning that you're quite busy.
Don't call me. Please don't call.
All right, this email's from patron Ashley, and she says, I'm in my first year of graduate school. Or no, in my first year of graduate school in the past, I was placed in a community health clinic doing outpatient therapy. I worked with a variety of clients, including both children and adults. Although I'm not happy about it, I did have a favorite client. What do you think, Rebecca? Is it okay to have a favorite client?
Everybody has a favorite client.
Yeah. Who's been your favorite client? Would you?
Oh, I've had some favorites. But when I was at my first internship, no, my second internship, I had a favorite client for sure.
What defines a favorite client?
I just looked forward so much to seeing them every week because they were such a unique and spirited presence on the planet. And I just kept them in my heart, and I thought, even now I can still picture this very young person's face. I still think about them. Something about them really touched me.
So by definition, you have a least favorite client too?
Oh, I think everybody's had a least favorite client too.
All right.
It's
Patron
like
Ashley goes on and says, my favorite client, he was someone who struggled with opioid addiction for 10 years. I first met him while he was actively detoxing. We worked together for 8 months. He was sober while we worked together. Although inappropriate, he was the one client that I did not terminate communication with at the end of my internship. I
Red
can,
flag.
I, yeah, red flag. I continued to talk with him because I had every intention of getting another outpatient job and continuing to see him at my new job. I also believed that the core to his suffering and substance use was his lack of security due to his troubling childhood. I wanted to continue to be the secure base that he never had before. What are your thoughts on that, Rebecca?
No good. No good. How's that for a clinical opinion?
Well,
No good.
what are you worried about? What are you worried about?
Well, this is common that people think since they've connected with this person, they're the only person that will ever connect with this person. This was actually one of my big things that I would shut down in consultation when someone would say, I'm the only person that can reach this client, or we're told that our agency is the only client, is the only place that these clients are reached. And I would say, no.
Yeah.
It's not a good attitude to have as a clinician.
Why?
It's not good for the clients. It's not good for the institution. Think of it, hopefully what you're teaching is you've connected to me, and you'll connect safely to the next person too. But this idea that somehow, you are the magic salve that this person has been waiting for their whole life, it sets you up, it sets the power dynamic up too much. No good.
Yeah, what do we call that? What do we call what you're describing in the business?
Inflated sense of importance? I don't know. What do you call that?
Well, it's related to the savior complex, right?
Yes. So that's a directive I love to do with people. Are you a therapist or are you a rescuer?
Yeah, how do you tell the difference?
Well, that's where the discussion starts. I mean, people need to start being able to see the difference themselves.
Yeah.
But this idea, here's a big signal. I'm the only one who can blah, blah, blah.
Right.
I mean, maybe you're the only one that can make your special really yummy souffle. But in clinical settings, being the only one that could reach this client, it's not a good attitude. It's not a attitude that will keep you in the business very long because you need a team working with lots of people.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's just not realistic to think of things that way. It's not accurate, I think, as you're saying. And it's also not realistic in terms of your career because you're going to become in contact with thousands of different people, and there are going to be a percentage of them that you're going to conclude that your relationship with this person, your developed attachment, is an important part of their well-being and their development, which is not inaccurate to say. But if all of those people you go beyond your professional boundaries, then you're not going to have any room for anything else, because you'll have hundreds of these sorts of people in your life that you're not getting paid for and that are invading your space, you know? So there's that. It's totally normal. I mean, everyone goes through this. Every therapist goes through a period. I mean, did you go through a period where you played around with these notions, Rebecca?
I mean, I think, you know, we all want to feel like we're that special person.
Yeah.
So I think, yes. And it's easy to feel, and I use the word grandiose kind of lightly, not lightly here, but it's when you first start doing the work, it's pretty amazing that somebody needs you and somebody wants you and you have this job and this person tells you all kinds of things and it feels kind of special. It's just the longer you do the work, you realize like somebody might even tell you that you're the special person, but you know, and then it turns out they tell everybody that. Like, I mean, so one of the questions I would have that for that clinician is, what if it turns out that this client has told other clinicians that they're the special one?
Yeah.
How would that make you feel? Like maybe that's part of their pathology that they tell everyone that.
Yeah, totally. And it's also possible that this client legitimately, you know, had for the first time someone in his life that he could connect to. It doesn't necessarily mean that he is, you know, saying this to everyone. But it could be for sure. But yeah, so all of us, including you and I, have at the beginning of our career had times where, because, you know, as you say, we get into this business because it's an amazing experience. We have a deep desire to help people. And in the beginning of our careers, we may have only a handful of clients that we really connect with, that we really feel like we're doing good work with. And you know, by the time you get to our stage, 20 some odd years into it, we've had thousands of people that we've worked well with, you know? And so
and another thousand that didn't work out.
Right.
Like, you know, I mean, you kind of start to see the law of averages kind of bumps up more. And you're like, oh,
right.
Sometimes it works out. Sometimes it doesn't.
Right. And my point is that when you and I meet the thousandth and the thousandth and oneth or whatever first, the thousandth and first client that we connect with, we're like, well, this isn't shocking, you know, it's nice when it happens, but it's happened many times before. But when you're at your internship, like I said, you might have just maybe even just one or two clients that you really feel like you're doing great work with. And so it's hard to put that in perspective, and it's hard to let go, and it's hard to truly terminate with them when you leave your internship. And most, if not all, clinicians at this stage will at least play around with the idea of breaking their professional boundaries by allowing further contact outside of termination. And I remember being this way myself. I remember with some clients just having a really deep desire to at least want to know what's happening in their life.
Right. What happened next?
Yeah. I was so invested and so micro invested in their life that I was just like, man, are they going to pass their classes? Are they going to graduate from high school? Are they going to stay out of jail? Are they going to stay sober? Are they going to, you know, stay alive? What's going to happen to this person? And it was so hard to just say goodbye and not have any way of connecting with this person. So I would, you know, say that sometimes. I'd say like, well, feel free to, you know, call me and, you know, let me know how you're doing and that kind of stuff. Now that's a far cry from staying in actual contact with an ex-client. You know, just leaving your professional phone number open to updates is one thing. But anyway, yeah. So it's we call it savior complex. It's normal, but it's not advised. You know, you really just have to bite the bullet when you terminate and just move on. It's hard. You know, you want to set up your client with as much resources as possible, enough, you know, as many recommendations as needed. And then, you know, you document it in your file and you grieve, and it could be sad. You might even cry. You might talk with your supervisor, your friends, your colleagues, your own therapist. But you got to move on. You can't hold on to that.
And think of it as good practice for what's next.
Right.
I mean, because this work is so much about terminating over, and sometimes you get to terminate. A lot of times you don't even get to terminate. People just disappear.
Right.
So you having the skills to practice a good termination is just as important as, you know, your client saying goodbye.
Yeah, agreed. So she goes on and she says in the email, I also worked at a restaurant in town. He would visit me from time to time, have some food, and update me about his sober life. Again, same alarm. You want to make that alarm signal sound again?
I can't remember what the last one was. Whoop, whoop, whoop.
Yeah, exactly. Same sort of thing. It seems harmless, and it might be harmless, but there's a lot of problems. For instance, confidentiality. You know, he comes in to your restaurant, and I'm guessing you're a food server of some sort, and he is at a table and he's talking to you, and anyone in that restaurant can hear that conversation. Your coworkers will come up to you and say, wow, so that guy was a client of yours at your previous, you know, at your other job. And that is a game you do not want to play, because you could get in big trouble for that, one. And two, you're kind of playing into a potential harmful situation for the client where they could be harmed by the breaking of confidentiality. Plus, to set a precedent where
that's what I was going to say.
Yeah, where you allow your, you know, any client to just come to your other job and start talking to you. With this client, you didn't mind, but what about all your other clients? What if you have other clients in the restaurant who see this? One, are they going to go, oh, so I have free reign to come into this restaurant and talk with my therapist whenever I want to? Or other clients are going to be like, wait a second, so this therapist clearly has this other client whom she really likes and prefers over me, or wait, is this therapist unprofessional? It creates a situation that you don't want to get into.
I was actually going to go the other way and say, do us all a favor and represent the field.
Right.
Because imagine this client goes on to other therapists saying, well, my last therapist still lets me hang out at their restaurant. Why don't you have a relationship with me after our session is over?
Right.
So you're setting a precedent that no other therapist is going to be able to meet.
Yeah.
If they're following ethical boundaries.
Yeah. And people in the restaurant observing this will have a similar notion put in their heads. So we all need to represent the field well. The other thoughts that I had was, who's your supervisor? Did they sign off on this? And what did your training tell you about this? Now, again, Patron Ashley is like, I know this was wrong, you know.
Right.
So actually, this is leading up to her main question, but she's just sort of.
We're not even at the main question yet.
No. Actually, this takes a turn in a second. But so then she goes on. 4 months after we stopped working together, he relapsed and
died. Right. I was waiting for this.
Yeah, and he died from an overdose.
Right. What does it mean that she couldn't save him? So you think that being their buddy means that they won't relapse, but what is it? There's no way to predict that. And what if they relapse?
Right.
Would you blame yourself that much more because you couldn't save them?
Right. Yeah. She says she was devastated by his death. She says, I had seen him just 2 days prior to his death. He came to work for food and to check in. He told me about a position he was offered through the homeless shelter as a peer counselor. She says, I felt blindsided and guilty about his death. Although I have been attending to those feelings in my own therapy, I still feel paralyzed professionally.
Right. So it sets up this dynamic of intimacy, which is why the field has boundaries in the first place.
Right.
so that you, you know, hopefully don't get in these situations where it's become so intimate, you're sharing food together, you know, and kind of your off time.
Right.
And, you know, you just can't maintain that if something truly devastating. Like, this happens and people relapse.
Yeah.
That's why there's a word for it. I mean, I think the average person goes to rehab like 7 times or something. I mean, it's kind of, it's yeah. expected.
Right. Yeah. The part of the reason for the boundaries, as you say, is to protect your soul and your spirit, because especially if you're working with particular sorts of people, because if you allow all these people into your heart, then every week you're going to lose another person that's close to you. And so the boundaries are for your own countertransference reasons. But anyway, she goes on, I've noticed myself no longer interested in working clinically. Maybe because I don't want to lose another client, or maybe mm-hmm. because I don't want to risk not being able to save a client from themselves. I was wondering if you could speak more to grieving the death of a client, particularly mm-hmm. to addiction. How can I heal, grieve, and continue forward? Any thoughts about that, Rebecca?
Oosh. This is so interesting because I was just asked to put together a 6-hour continuing education class on art therapy for grief and loss. And so I've been doing a deep dive into my experience of grief and loss as an individual, as a supervisor. So there was a client that died at my very first job. Can I have time to tell a little story?
Absolutely.
Okay. Oof, this one was a doozy. So this was a similar to this client, dual diagnosis unit, chemically dependent, chronically mentally ill, outpatient program. And there was an older gentleman. There was a morning meeting system, and you could get elected to be president and run the morning meeting. And if they chose to really invest in the program, it was a statement about how much the community thought you were doing well. So this guy gets elected as president and will be running the meetings for 3 months following that. And that night he goes home and has a catastrophic heart attack and dies. And so Monday morning, we had to tell the whole community that he had died, and people were devastated. And this is a population that was really easily activated. And it was incredibly painful to grieve it as a community. And it was interesting. My next group, I ran a sewing group for 2 hours, and people began to make a chair for him. They took one of the chairs from the meeting room and wrapped it like a memorial for him with his initials. And it was really powerful. But, you know, I mean, death is, wow, it changes everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. What else to say about that?
Yeah, exactly. Death is difficult. Loss is difficult. Especially sudden death is difficult. Grief takes time. Patron Ashley, you're asking, how can you heal and grieve and move forward? Up to the point of you talking about the client dying, we've been saying boundaries, boundaries, boundaries. But now that you had let him into your heart and he had died, you can't have boundaries now because, you know, it's already done and your feelings are going to be there, and there's no way to have that go well for you. If your father died similarly, or your spouse or your good friend died similarly, or your son died similarly, you're not going to get over that anytime soon. That is something you're going to be suffering from and thinking about and affecting you for months, if not years. So, and it's something that I often talk about with people. I say, because a lot of people will ask me, clients, students, you know, listeners to the podcast will say, you know, how do I heal? How do I grieve? How do I get over this? And what I say is, you know, that's not the right question. The question is how do I move through this pain, you know, or how do I accept this pain? You know, how do I accept the fact that I am now going to be living in pain for a long time? And that's a hard thing to do. It's hard to accept the fact that you're going to be in pain for a long time. because in our society, we don't talk about grief, we don't talk about loss. And so people are quite surprised at how much it hurts.
Mm-hmm.
And they're quite surprised at how long it lasts. I mean, I have people 20 years later still suffering. And that is not abnormal. That's, you know, for, in fact, it would be abnormal for some losses to not be in pain 20 years later. It would mean you're a psychopath or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's interesting. As I am preparing for this presentation, I'm kind of reviewing so many of my clients come because of a loss of a parent. And I have one client in particular who the loss is incredibly painful for. And she'll often make a misstatement of how long ago her father died. She'll often say, like, just last year. And just to clarify for myself, in a time where she wasn't despondent, I just double-checked and we did the math, and it had been over 5 years. But it's so fresh for her, you know, it feels like it just happened.
Right. And grief is the way that it is because of our humanness. We, in the same way that we need attachments and we need other people, and we are absolutely dependent on our relationships to other people, and that's a good thing. When we lose those people, it hurts. It is we are biologically designed, so to speak, through selection to be attached, and the dark side of that attachment is that when we lose someone, it's going to hurt for a long time. If it didn't hurt when we lost someone, then we never really cared to begin with, and of course we really care. And grief is good in a way. I try to at least put a silver lining on it sometimes by saying that it's an indication that we care. It's an indication that we had a good relationship with someone. Now, again, many of us would say, Patron Ashley, that your relationship with this client was not advised. But you putting all that professionalism aside and that criticism aside, you cared about this man and you were in his life and he was in your life. And you met some of his needs and he met some of your needs. Again, we advise you not to go down that road in the future. But, that's the reality. You were mutually involved in each other's lives, and that's a nice thing. It's not professionally advised, but it's a nice thing. It's an altruistic thing. It's a connection thing. Your intention was good. You wanted to help, and you were helping, but you were opening yourself up to this huge pain. This isn't to say that if you had drawn boundaries, this wouldn't have hurt. But it probably just would have hurt less, or you would never have even found out, which is kind of an odd thing to think about, right? But anyway, so just a short primer on. Now, I'm writing an entire book on grief that I've been writing for the past 3+ years, and I'm probably halfway done. So, but in a nutshell, self-care around grief is you want to continue to talk about it, process it. Make art about it, create about it, let it out of you when you feel compelled to. Don't keep it inside. And the other thing is you want to, research shows that there's no stages of grief, but research does show that we vacillate between two positions, between a position of feeling the grief and reminiscing and being in pain and, grieving. And then the other position is a position of moving on. This might be forgetting about it, not thinking about it, maybe even being in denial about it. And we go back and forth naturally between those two positions. And so as a griever, it's up to you to sense where your body wants to go. And that's a hard thing to detect. And sometimes there's barriers to going either direction. And so it's kind of complicated. And if you find trouble, then I would definitely specifically talk with your therapist about it. Having said that, a lot of therapists don't know what they're doing when it comes to grief. And so just be skeptical of your therapist regarding that.
Well, and I would also say, to if you're really stuck in a grief process, research your own family history around grief. Because often what I've found with clients is we're kind of grieving this death, but there might be other intergenerational deaths that have never really been addressed.
Right.
Or look into how many cultures deal with death. Western culture, kind of a big dud when it comes to death.
Totally.
But other cultures do death really well.
Yeah.
And there's lots of room for, I mean, think of, you know, in Italy, women are allowed to be widows for the rest of their lives if they so choose. Right. In Judaism, you say the mourner's kaddish every day for 30 days.
Yeah.
And then it's your choice whether you go to synagogue every week for a year. In fact, if you go to any Jewish synagogue anywhere in the world, you can put your deceased friend's name on a list and you can stand when they read the mourner's kaddish and they will say his name out loud. So there's lots of places to grieve with a community, even in the way that in our culture, there's like, you know, there's nowhere to go. There's also yoga for grief and loss, which I've also, a lot of clients who feel like they have no space in their room in their lives have gone to that and had a good experience and just cried it out on the floor with a bunch of other people who were sad.
Yeah. What's that movie with Adam Driver in which I think the father dies and then they all sit in these like short chairs? I think they're Jewish, just a Jewish family. Do you know about that custom?
I don't know that one.
It's
sword chairs.
Yeah, like, God, I could be butchering it, but I think it's this. It's a Jewish sort of like a family drama comedy, and it has Justin Bateman in it as well, and it has a bunch of famous people. But some I think their father dies, if I'm not mistaken, and so all the siblings come back home. And I think for a week or for a few days, they all sit in this room together.
Mourners, that's their sitting kaddish. I don't know about the short chairs, though.
Oh, well, I could be making that up. But you sit in a room and people come and visit. And
yeah.
Oh, okay.
Sitting and, Shiva.
Okay.
Sitting Shiva.
So, you know, let's just put aside my bumbling of that tradition to that movie and move on. Other self-care things, patron Ashley, is to protect yourself, because most people are terrible when it comes to reacting to grief, especially something like this, because they're going to be like, well, it's a client, why do you care? Or, well, you know, people who use drugs, they die, or some, you know, they're not going to, a lot of people have a really hard time. Because our culture is just so backward and childish when it comes to grief, a lot of people don't know how to react in a way that is caring or in a way that helps you. They want to help, but they're just so bad at it that or anxious or something. And so just you have to protect yourself from certain people. You'll realize who are the people that understand and listen well, and the people who don't. Also, as I was saying earlier, you want to try to move towards accepting the fact that you will be grieving for a while. You know, it's normal. It's a part of life. And once you accept that grieving, it will be less bothersome to you, if that makes any sense. So, Rebecca, what advice professionally for the future do you have?
Oh, well, can I give one more way of contextualizing grief?
Yeah.
That I actually showed up for my presentation. I did some research on it and discovered it was much older than I thought it was. In that sense that when you come across something, you think it's new when really it's been sitting around forever. So this is Warden from 1991. This is his model of grief, and it's the tasks of grief. It spells out tear. So T is to accept the reality of the loss. E is to experience the pain of the loss. A is to adjust to the new environment without the lost person. And R is to reinvest in a new reality. And that is one of the models I use with my clients, and people have found it really helpful. So I offer that model.
Great. All right, well, let's take a break, and when we get back, we'll go into professional advice for the future. What do you say?
Okay.
All right, we're back from the break. If you haven't already become a patron of the podcast, do so by going to patreon.com. That's patreon.com. Go there, become a patron of the podcast, and get access to all of our patron exclusive episodes. We have hundreds of them. All right, so
plus there's the mug.
Plus there's, well, if you're a $20 patron, then you get a mug.
Because I'm on the mug.
I know, it's a great mug. It's my favorite. It's my favorite mug. It's actually a very, I would use this mug even if my mug was not on the mug. Or
I'm
your
mug. I'm so excited to be on the mug.
All right, so for Patron Ashley, advice for professional stuff. The main thing here that we're both trying to tell you is boundaries and trying not to be the savior. You will very quickly burn out, as you already are experiencing right now. You're already having the classic burnout symptom, which is that you don't want to work anymore. Because when you go to work, it's associated with all this pain and all this loss and all this powerlessness. And that would happen anyway, even if you did have appropriate and therapeutic boundaries with this client, but it would have been a lot less hurtful. So you don't want to burn out. Plus, you don't want to let your savior complex, which is true to most therapists, if not all, you don't want your savior complex to ruin your career through confidentiality complaints or getting sued or being written up or something. It's just not worth it. It's hard to say goodbye, and it's hard to let go.
But the more practice you get, the sooner in your career, the better.
Right.
Like, I mean, this is just that's what happens in this work. It's, I have said goodbye so many times.
Right.
And that's what the work asks for us, from us. And right. So it's important to get used to that. It's a very strange part of this work. Very, very strange.
Yeah. Right. Hopefully, Patron Ashley, in your career, you will help thousands upon thousands of people. And if you're going to be able to, you know, change all those people's lives and help all those people and have therapeutic attachments with all those people, then you have to have an ability to say goodbye and move on. Otherwise, your life will be ruined by this career and you won't be able to help anybody. So it's actually an altruistic thing to all your future clients that you draw boundaries with your current clients when needed. The other thing that I want to say is if you're working with addicts, particularly opioid addicts, you need to be realistic about their prognosis. When I was reading your email, before you got to the part of him passing away, before you got to him dying, I was already thinking that he might die. And why do I think that? Well, because I've had opioid clients die or almost die. Opioid, you know, people who are addicted to opioids frequently die from accidental overdose. It's one of the hallmarks of heroin addiction and other, you know, particularly heroin addiction. Most opioid addictions will lead to heroin because it's the cheapest and the easiest to access as opposed to like Percocet and stuff. Many famous people have died from accidental heroin overdose. Philip Seymour Hoffman, River Phoenix, John Belushi, Sid Vicious, Basquiat, Mitch Hedberg, Lane Staley, Andrew Wood of Mother Love Bone, Corey Monteith of Glee, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, and so on and so on and so on. None of these people, from what we can tell, wanted to die, but they wanted to live, and they were taking a normal dose, what they thought was a normal dose.
Right.
And
that guy from Glee, as we podcast, it's the anniversary of his death within a few weeks, or his birthday. There was a bunch of stuff on him on social media, and I just remember, you know, I was a Glee fanatic, loved that show so much. I didn't know he had an addiction history.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, the story was he went home for the weekend, he was alone in his hotel room, and he overdosed.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's that kind of quick and simple, and especially these days when stuff is cut with all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah. And the main thing is when people relapse because they don't realize that their tolerance has plummeted and they don't need their regular dose. Because as you build a tolerance, you need more and more to get high. And So this guy presumably was sober for a number of months, and when he relapsed, he probably went to a similar dosage in the past, and that's when people die, because he probably only needed like 10% of what he actually gave himself. So there's all that. Plus, so if you're working with heroin users, you really have to prepare yourself for the very real possibility that your clients might die. When I was working more often with opioid addicts, I had one client who right after, or maybe even during my session, she went outside and shot up, and she accidentally overdosed, and she passed out on the sidewalk.
Wow.
And someone saw her and called the ambulance, and she went to the hospital. But I didn't know, because it was far enough away from my office that I didn't know. And the next time I saw her, she told me about this, and it was terrifying. That I was just talking with her, and then right after that, she went out and overdosed and nearly died. And it felt horrifying that. I, you know, what should I have done differently to get her what if she had died?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a scary thing. And you just realize that when it comes to opioid addiction, it's so powerful that you as a therapist are a tiny little ant in comparison to the power of, you know, just you, if you watch Game of Thrones, you know, the heroin addiction is like the mountain, right? Or a dragon or something. And you're nothing compared to the power of that thing. The other thing is as I was reading your email, and you were like, yeah, I was working with this opioid person who had opioid addiction, and he was sober for this time. When I read that, I was like, well, as far as you know, because I've worked with, again, opioid addicts and have realized that the shame runs so deep for them that even though they know that they could tell me, they still won't tell me sometimes when they are back on when they fall off the wagon. And I've had that exhibited to me time and time again, where I've been like, okay, surely this time I can be very, very sure that this person is being honest about their sobriety. And every once in a while, you know, I'll come to realize that person was using the entire time I was working with them. And so you just have to, when you're working with people who struggle with addictions, you just have to realize how powerful the addiction is. And it's another reason why you want to just keep your distance a little bit, because there's a chance that they're not even telling you the truth. Not that they're bad people. They're good people, but addiction is a very, very, very powerful thing, and opioid addiction is perhaps the most powerful. So, any final words, Rebecca, about this situation and for Patron Astrally?
Well, I was just thinking about the client that came in the other day with the sniffles and told me that they had used cocaine quite prolifically in the week previous.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, don't do that. So, yeah, our clients, you know, things happen, unexpected things happen. People make choices that you yourself could never imagine making, but it doesn't mean that doesn't happen. And so part of having boundaries is to protect yourself from, you know, people's lives are very intense and unimaginable.
Right.
If you haven't grown up in a culture where there's heavy drug use and violence, you know, some of these situations can be really unexpected. So there was an interesting article in the New York Times about substance abuse among lawyers, including heroin use. There was a woman whose ex-husband had passed away, and she found him, and she said to the medics, "I don't know what happened." And they said, "Oh, honey, he overdosed on heroin." And she was like, no, no, that can't possibly what's happening. And they were right, because they see it all the time. And this whole thing unfolds as she tries to put together the last years of his life, realizing, you know, even in all the pickups and drop-offs of their time co-parenting, that he was high on heroin. And she couldn't see the signs. So, yeah, I think, you know, even people who are intimate in this situation might miss what's going on, not just the therapist.
Right. Yeah, and the thing to remember about opioid addiction is for a lot of people, it's essentially a maintenance issue. They will use it to survive, to stave off withdrawal symptoms. And they will use it to get normal. They won't be entirely normal as if they had been sober for a year or something, but they're not going to be walking around stumbling or slurring their words or anything. They get just enough dosage so that they can get through the day. In the same way that the first time you smoked a cigarette, you were like, whoa, I feel dizzy. But the thousandth time you smoked a cigarette, it didn't do anything to you. It just brought you up to normal, right? And so with a lot of opioid, people who suffer from opioid addiction, that's what they're dealing with. And a lot of them will only use to the point of intoxication when they can, when they know that there's not going to be anyone around or something. And that's when they use more of a higher dose so that they can get high, so to speak. But I find that a lot of, including myself, I used to think that people who used heroin were just like, because the way they portray it in the movies and stuff, it's just like they're completely whacked out of their minds and they're complete junkies and they don't make any sense and they're crazy people. But if you've ever taken a pain medication like Percocet or OxyContin or something, that's all that it is. It doesn't make you a crazy person. It takes away your pain and it slows you down. And so anyway. Well, thanks for joining me in this podcast, Rebecca. That was that for that episode. Patron Ashley, let us know how you're doing. And I hope that you're doing well. And I hope that you can grieve well. And I hope that you can get back in the saddle and start helping people again. Because there's a lot of people out there who need someone like you who cares a lot. And I'm sure that in the future you will avoid getting into these kinds of boundary issues because now you know the hazards of that. That does it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining us out there. Please take care of yourself because why should they keep care of themselves, Rebecca?
Well, it's really a service to the universe to care for yourself. It's a gift.
That's right.